Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How rare is life in the universe, or how common? Could there be one other planet like Earth, or 100, or 1,000,000? About 3 weeks ago, NASA launched its Kepler spacecraft to fulfill an extraordinary mission, searching the Milky Way for planets that orbit stars beyond our sun. Scientists already know about several hundred, but expect a vastly greater number of exoplanets to come to light with new data from Kepler and from Europe's Corot telescope. So how do they do it? And what information do they need to determine how closely any of those faraway globes might resemble the only planet known to house millions of life forms, Earth? Alan Boss is a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. He explores some of these scientific challenges in his new book, The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Alan, welcome to Think.
Good afternoon, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
It's so amazing to think that we've only had confirmation of any planets outside our own solar system for a few years now, and then we're talking about identifying potentially thousands of them.
That's right. It's just back in 1995, a little over 10 years ago, that the first reproducible evidence for planets around sun-like stars came to light. And so now we're just a little over 10 years into a new era of the discovery of new planetary systems. And in those 10 years, the amount of discoveries we've made are just truly amazing. As you mentioned, there have been hundreds of planets found so far, some of them in systems containing at least five planets, which is amazing considering our solar system only has eight planets at the moment. And the types of planets that are found look very much, in some cases, like the ones in our own solar system.
How were those first exoplanets discovered?
The very first ones were found by the so-called Doppler wobble technique. And that technique is the indirect method where you don't actually see the planet directly. You infer its presence by what it does to its host star. And the basic technique is based on the fact that something we all learn in elementary school is not quite right. We're taught that planets orbit around the star. That's not really exactly right. In reality, both the planet and the star orbit around a common point in space called the center of mass of the system. It's basically like the balance point on a teeter-totter. If you can imagine a teeter-totter with the sun on one side and the planets on the other, the place where the fulcrum is for the teeter-totter is the center of mass, where you balance out the amount of mass. In the case of our sun and Jupiter, for example, Jupiter is 1,000 times less massive than the sun. And so the balance point for the Jupiter-Sun system is 1,000 times closer to the sun than it is to Jupiter. And as a result of that, that means that the sun orbits around the center of mass once every 12 years, which is Jupiter's period, and moves at a velocity of about 30 miles per hour. So what the Doppler technique does is actually measure that change in velocity of the sun around its center of mass. If you're looking at it from a nearby star, you would see the sun for a couple of years move away from us at 30 miles per hour, and 6 years later come at us at 30 miles per hour. You would notice that for some reason it's wobbling in space, as it were. It's changing its velocity. And that's the Doppler technique. There's an Austrian physicist, Christian Doppler, who showed back in the 1800s that if you have a source which is emitting light and coming at you, or emitting sound for that same argument, it's basically the same as an ambulance coming at you, its frequency of its siren changes as it comes at you and goes away from you. You can measure that change in the wavelength or the frequency of the light. If you could do that very precisely, you can measure that plus or minus 30 miles per hour that the sun is doing, and detect that, well, there's no other reason for it except for it must be orbiting around its center of mass, meaning it has a planet. So of the 350 or so planets found so far, roughly 300 of them have been found by this Doppler technique, which is quite successful.
How well do we understand how our own solar system formed?
That is one of the major questions that scientists are still working on. We pretty much believe we understand how Earth-like planets form. By the collisional accumulation process, that is, by banging together progressively larger and larger solids. We know from studies of young star systems which have disks of gas and dust around them, which are the leftovers from the star formation process. That's what planets basically are. They're the leftovers, the stuff that did not fall in to form a star. These dust grains in orbit around young stars have quite small sizes, much less than a micron, which is a millionth of a meter in size. So they're quite tiny. But once they get together in this disk, they have a good chance of hitting each other and growing and sticking. They basically form little dust bunnies, like the dust bunnies under your bed. And the dust bunnies keep running into each other and grow into larger and larger dust bunnies. Eventually, they get into sort of centimeter-sized pebbles and meter-sized boulders and cometary-sized, kilometer-sized planetesimals. And those, over time scales of maybe 100 million years, smash into each other and form the rocky terrestrial planets, just like we believe the planets in our inner solar system formed over the last little over 4.5 billion years ago. So that part of the process is pretty well understood and agreed upon. There is still some argument, though, over how the gas giant planets, planets like Jupiter and Saturn and the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, how they formed. There are basically two competing theories of doing that. One is that you just let the collisional accumulation process proceed and let it perhaps grow to something on the order of 10 Earth masses in size. And at that point, it can pull in enough gas from the nebula to form a final ice giant planet, which is, in the case of Jupiter, has something like 318 times the mass of the Earth. There is also, however, a competing theory, which I've been espousing, which says maybe you can actually form a self-gravitating clump of gas and dust right directly in the nebula without having to build up a rocky core first. And if that process works, it's a very fast process, and so it gives you actually a chance to build a lot of gas giants in situations where the disk gas maybe doesn't last quite as long. So that one we're still trying to figure out which process works the most. We, given the great variety of planets found so far, probably both processes have to operate somewhere in the universe. But the encouraging thing is that even if you can make our solar system that way, it implies that because this disk and Svelte process works so quickly, you might be able to form solar systems practically anywhere in the galaxy, which means that solar system analogs, where you have Earth-like planets, could be commonplace.
So is there any reason to believe that if we were looking at our own solar system from the distance that we're now looking at all these others, that we would think more than one planet in our solar system was likely to be hospitable to life?
If we had the right space telescope, we could. We're just now in the process of being able to develop such space telescopes. As you mentioned before, NASA has launched the Kepler mission, which is NASA's first space telescope designed primarily and single-heartedly to find Earth-like planets. So if we happen to be looking at our solar system from the right angle, right position in space, we would see that the solar system's orbits could be aligned such that the planets pass in front of the star periodically. In the case of the Earth would pass in front of our sun once every year or so, and the Earth being 100 times smaller in size than the sun will dim roughly a part in 10,000 of the sun's light because it goes as the area, which goes as the size of the planet squared. So our sun, if you happen to look at it from the right position in space, would every year dim by a tiny part, one part in 10,000, a hundredth of a percent. And that's exactly the sort of technique that Kepler is using to find Earth-like planets. So if we were looking at our sun from a nearby star and had just the right position in space, we would infer that, gee, for some reason the sun-like star is dimming every year, just the right orbital period for water to be present on the surface of a planet that was there. And the explanation would be, well, this sun-like star must have an Earth-like planet, and that's what Kepler is going to be doing for us.
And the orbit, and you started to explain this, it's important that it has an Earth-like period of orbit because that tells us how much water might remain on the planet?
Right. Basically, by getting the period of the orbit, we go back to something called Kepler's third law, which relates the distances of the planets from their star with the orbital period. And so using that relationship, we can tell how far away the planet is from the star. Then knowing how luminous the star is, how bright it is, how much energy it's giving off, we can do a simple calculation to see whether or not we expect that planet could have liquid water on its surface. And basically, we think that liquid water is one of the prerequisites for life, at least life as we know it, which, of course, we have to sort of assume we can look for life like our own since we have no basis for thinking otherwise. So the hope is that Kepler will find many, many Earth-like planets roughly dimming their star's light by an amount which is indicative of an Earth-sized planet, and it'll find that dimming to be periodic with periods of order a year for a sun-like star, which implies that that planet is not only the Earth size, but also is orbiting at a distance where it could have liquid water. And so, therefore, Kepler will be telling us for the first time, really determining how many potentially habitable worlds there are in our galaxy.
Alan Boss is my guest. His new book is called The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Are there particular kinds of stars, Alan, that seem to be the most likely candidates for Earth-like planets?
Probably stars that are similar to our sun are the most promising because we've already searched them to a great extent and found that they have not only gas giant planets like Jupiter, often at the rate of 10 or 20%, but even more recently we've just realized that sun-like stars have a large number of what we call hot, warm super-Earths. These are objects which we think are the tip of the iceberg of the terrestrial planet mass spectrum. These are objects with masses on the order of maybe 5, 10, 15 Earth masses. They orbit closer to their suns than the Earth does, so they're sort of like Venus-like or Mercury-like orbits, and so we call them hot and warm super-Earths because they tend to be a little bit too hot for liquid water to be on them. But the best estimates right now are that something like one-third of sun-like stars have these hot and warm super-Earths. And these are the planets which are much easier to find by the Doppler technique than the Earth-like planets because They're much more massive, and they are closer in, which makes it much easier to get a big wobble out of the star. And for those combined factors, you sort of find the easy ones first, and the Earth-like planets, which Kepler will be looking for, are harder to find. In fact, they're really difficult to find by Doppler techniques. Those, we think, must be even much more numerous. And since we already know these hot and warm super-Earths are there roughly one-third of the time, there isn't too much more room between, you know, one-third of the time and 100% of the time. So the prediction is that basically Kepler is going to find that, you know, to roughly speaking, essentially every sun-like star is probably going to have an Earth-like planet or two.
What's the difference between what Kepler is able to do and what CORA, the European spacecraft, is doing?
Right. Kepler is in a race, as it were, with the French satellite CORO, which is
CORO.
The acronym stands for C-O-R-O-T, which stands for Convection, Rotation, and Planetary Transits. CORO was launched by the French and the European Space Agency just a little over 2 years ago with a primary purpose not of finding planets, but rather of studying stellar variability to understand how stars oscillate and how waves travel through their interior in order to basically understand the interiors of stars. It's very much stellar seismology is the name of the field. It's just like studying sound waves on the Earth and understanding how those waves tell us about the Earth's inner core. So the astronomers built CORO in order to find out what stars are like on their inside, but they realized at the same time if they're staring at stars and watching them oscillate, they could also look for these periodic dimmings caused by planets in orbits around the star. So it would also be useful for transits. So that's why they sort of added on the acronym. After the CO and the RO, they throw on the T for transits. So CORO is not optimized for finding transiting planets, but it actually does a pretty good job. And it's found something like six planets so far, including one of them, the smallest sized planet ever found, which is roughly twice the size of the Earth, a little bit smaller than that. They don't really know the mass of the planet, but they certainly have scored a coup there by finding that very small orbiting object. So CORO is also a transit-based telescope, and Kepler, though, has the advantage that it really is designed from the ground up to find planets. And so Kepler, for example, is over three times the diameter of CORO, which means it can measure much variations due to transits in much fainter stars. It also has a field of view roughly 20 times larger than the field of view studied by CORO, so it can look at any one time at least 20 times more stars, which gives you more chances of finding the transiting planets. And finally, most importantly, CORO is only going to be staring at a certain field of stars for no more than maybe 5 months at a time. And since you want to see multiple transits to make sure you really are seeing a repeatable phenomena, that means that CORO cannot find planets with orbits much longer than a month or two. And so you cannot find, by definition, Earth-like planets with year-long orbital periods because CORO just won't stare at any stars long enough to see if they repeat. Kepler, on the other hand, is designed to look at one field of stars for at least 3.5 years, maybe four, even longer, if NASA gives them money to keep going. And so Kepler is uniquely able to find Earth-like planets with Earth-like year-long orbital periods by staring over and over again for a long time and seeing those transits repeat long enough that we can really be sure that we're seeing, that we know it is what we're seeing. So Kepler will do a bang-up job of finding out exactly how many Earths there are in the universe.
I know there's a lot of competition between the CORO folks and the Kepler folks. Are they sharing all the information they actually get?
Not everything is being shared. For example, this most recent CORO discovery of the planet roughly twice the size of the Earth, they've been rather coy about telling us exactly what the star's name is because they're still very much working on it themselves, trying to do Doppler follow-up work to see if they can do a better job of determining what the mass of the planet is. So it's a case where scientists have cordial relationships between the two projects, but there's certainly competition going on because both really want to do great science. But it's a friendly competition. It's the sort of thing that scientists are used to. We all sort of want each other to do well, but if possible, we would like to get there first. So it's a situation where we wish the best for CORO, and I'm sure they wish the best for Kepler. In fact, we had a Kepler science team meeting at Cape Canaveral a couple weeks ago, just before the launch of Kepler, and there was a CORO scientist there who gave us the latest update on what CORO is doing. So we're working hand in hand as well as we can while still maintaining a friendly competition.
Alan Boss is with us. His new book is called The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. You'll have a chance to ask your questions right after the break. Call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
It's You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism, Alan Boss. His new book is called The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak first to Jim in Carrollton. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
I wanted to ask why a planet of more or less mass than the Earth would cause problems, why that would not work.
You mean in terms of the Doppler technique or the transit technique, or what in particular did you have in mind?
No, I've heard that, and I don't understand why, that a planet that's very massive would not be a good place to look for life on Earth. I do understand why a planet that is much smaller would not have a magnetic field, perhaps, and not be able to protect against ultraviolet radiation. But I don't understand why a planet more massive than the Earth wouldn't work.
I think that is very much a question that scientists are debating right now. What you're talking about is perhaps whether or not some of these super-Earths that are found with masses of 5 or 10 or 15 times the mass of the Earth, whether or not those might really not be places where you want to buy real estate. And so some of the ideas that are involved are basically, for example, whether or not you have plate tectonics, how does the geodynamics of a planet operate with the much higher temperatures and densities associated with a more massive planet. But part of, I think, what's behind folks' opinions about this is that they always have in the back of their mind, they also want to be able to have a planet that can lead to intelligent life, something very much like our own. Where we've had, in the last 580 million years, this explosion of life known as the Cambrian explosion, where the previous life, which is basically all single-cell creatures, archaea and bacteria, were added there, joined by their multicellular colleagues, which led eventually to, of course, to human beings and to intelligent life. And so folks sort of have in the back of the mind all of the peculiarities of the Earth system and particularly the effects of the moon and all sorts of things, whether or not plate tectonics operates, whether or not that helps keep the Earth habitable and stable for intelligent beings to survive. That's an interesting argument, but as I say, that still is going on right now. I think the easier thing to do, actually, and which is actually testable, is to see whether or not habitable worlds have at least some sort of more primitive life form, the sort that characterized our planet for its first 3 or so billion years of life, when there were, as I said, single-cell creatures, archaea and bacteria, which do, however, leave behind a detectable signature. So even if there is a new nearby Earth that has intelligent civilizations on it, it would be very hard for us to detect their presence unless they happen to send us a radio signal. But if we have nearby Earths, which may very well be super-Earths with higher masses, they may very well have enough cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, to produce a fair amount of oxygen in their atmosphere by photosynthesis. They may even have methanogenic bacteria of the sorts that live in swamps, that could produce methane in the atmosphere. And if we can find nearby worlds which show evidence for both oxygen and methane, which normally would combine with each other if there's simply non-biological processes going on, if you can see a planet which has a strong oxygen signal as well as a methane signal, that's going to argue to us very strongly that that world actually is inhabited by something. You know, it may actually be dairy cows eating grass, or it may be simply methanogenic bacteria and blue-green algae, but we'll at least know that something there is alive. And that is something we can actually conceive of building a telescope right now to go out and launch it in 10 years to detect it and prove it whether or not it's alive or not at that level. As I say, it's much harder to see anything which is much advanced beyond that. We're not going to be able to take a picture of a dinosaur crawling around. But the SETI folks, of course, would love to hear a radio signal from someone. But that's basically the setup that I think that these hot and warm super-Earths, if we found one which was far enough out to have liquid water on it, that would be a very promising place to look for life, at least at this early single cellular level.
So before we send something like that out, how much would we be able to know about what sort of atmosphere a planet had? It's amazing enough to me that we can find these things and then determine their mass and their density. How much more would it take to know what the weather's like?
Well, amazingly, we've already been able to study the weather on some of these so-called hot Jupiters. These are gas giant planets like Jupiter in mass, which orbit very close to their stars. And these objects turn out to have rather violent atmospheres, and sometimes they're quite hot because they are so close to their stars. And by using clever observations with existing space telescopes, like the Hubble Space Telescope and the Spitzer Space Telescopes, scientists have been able to detect the presence of molecules in the atmospheres of these planets, which are actually several of the molecules that we will be looking for in Earth-like worlds, namely water, methane, and carbon dioxide. And so they've proven the case that we can actually detect molecules like that in the atmospheres of extrasolar planets. So now to go on to find those sorts of signatures in the atmospheres of Earth-like planets, none of our existing space-based assets can do that. We really do have to build a new generation of telescopes, which I think the Kepler mission will tell us how it is we want to build it, because Kepler will tell us how many Earths are out there. Do we have to search 100 stars or 1,000 stars to find an Earth? We'll know how better to design that space telescope, and Kepler gives us that answer. And then that next generation of space telescopes will be telescopes which can detect the planet's light directly. We'll no longer be looking for the planet's presence indirectly by looking for a Doppler wobble or by looking for a dimming in the star. Instead, we'll now be able to build a telescope which can see light coming from the planet itself directly, and see it spatially resolved, that is, off from the side of the star. And it's a pretty tough thing to do because planets, even though they're not that faint themselves, they're right next to something which is very bright. That's the problem. A planet like the Earth or even Jupiter is no fainter than a very distant galaxy of the sort that Hubble Space Telescope can take pictures of quite easily. But it's right next to a very bright object. It's the good analogy is imagining trying to look at a firefly or a gnat that's orbiting around or flying around a spotlight that's a searchlight that's pointed right in your eyes. You just can't see the little planet. But NASA's technology development folks at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, have put together several concepts for how to build a space telescope that can do the actual precise job of seeing that light from the planet. You can either do it in the optical by building something called a coronagraph, where basically you put your thumb over the star and try to block out the star's light, at least a very, very elegant thumb. You'd have to design it quite carefully, and then therefore pick up the light from the planet. Or else at infrared wavelengths, the concept is to build an interferometer in space. That is a sequence of space telescopes that are perhaps only a few meters in diameter but stretch out over maybe 100 meters in length and combine their light in such a way that you have the light from the star be nulled out or canceled in the same way that the sound waves can cancel out or either add constructively or destructively. You would build such an interferometer in space, and infrared wavelengths cancel out the star's light but still pick up light from the planets. And if that is done in either optical or infrared wavelengths, you'll actually be able to measure the light coming from that planet's atmosphere and look for several key molecules. Basically, you would look for carbon dioxide, which is a characteristic of the atmospheres of Venus, Earth, and Mars. All three of those terrestrial planets show strong carbon dioxide absorption. You also look for water, because we're looking for planets in the habitable zone. We'd like to actually see this effect, that the planet actually has some water in its atmosphere, which would be very reassuring. That basically tells you that the planet is inhabitable. Then you want to look for molecules which tell us that the planet is actually inhabited, and that's what we touched on briefly before. Then you're looking for either oxygen or ozone, which seems to come from photosynthesis on our planet primarily, and also methane, which also comes primarily from biological processes. So those are the big four biomarkers: carbon dioxide, water, methane, and oxygen or ozone. Those four, if we can see those four on a nearby planet, then we'll pretty much have a pretty strong case that, hey, that planet has got to be alive. Something's living there.
Is it impossible by definition for a star to orbit another more powerful star?
No. Stars actually most of the time occur in what are called binary systems, where one star orbits around another one. There are even a number of so-called multiple systems where you have, say, two stars orbiting around each other or a third star orbits around them much farther out. So that actually is the norm. Single stars like our sun are somewhat out of the ordinary. Roughly one-third of all stars are single, and most stars are actually in binary star systems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mark in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Hi there, and thank you for the show. My question is more economic than chemical. I was wondering, as I was listening to y'all, I was thinking about President Bush's announcement a few years back and going to Mars. And first of all, I was wondering, do you think that was a silly idea? And secondly, is there any money going to that? And if there is it still there, or could it be used on programs that seem much smarter, like these telescopes?
Yeah, when President Bush put forward his vision for space exploration back in 2004, certainly the focus was on returning the shuttle to flight, finishing the space station, and going on to the moon with the idea of going on to Mars. And it was a very ambitious program. And he also had in that program, believe it or not, buried a little bit farther down, in the context of why we would go to Mars, basically, which is to look for life. He also had that the goal that NASA should be building advanced space telescopes to look for Earth-like planets. So those of us who are planet aficionados, you know, heartily applauded that. We thought, wow, we're really off and running now. And in fact, at that point, JPL started planning to build two space telescopes to do this direct detection we're talking about before. They decided we don't have to choose between a chronograph and an interferometer. We'll build them both because they thought, wow, we really have the president's support behind us now. And so unfortunately, while the president gave us gave NASA that that directive for what to do, NASA's funding did not grow proportionately. And so basically the higher priority items, which were returning shuttle to flight after the Columbia disaster and you know, getting space station built and thinking about going back to the moon, those have been the highest priority efforts for at least NASA's human space side of the house. And the science side of the agency basically lost out in order to fix some of the funding problems that were came with these higher priority initiatives. Science lost money. So even the Mars program, which has wonderful science behind it, is not done as well as it could due to this robbing of funds, as well as the fact that some of the things they wanted to do turned out to be harder to do than they thought they would, so they cost quite a bit more. But our new president, President Obama, has yet to really develop his own space exploration. It'll be interesting to see what he proposes we should do. If he had something exactly like President Bush's plan, I don't expect that, since President Obama seems to often want to go in different directions. He has certainly already hinted that he would like to see NASA spend more money on global climate research. That's being a high priority, increasingly higher priority for the president administration than it was for the last administration. So far, there's not been much support from President Obama's for increasing the side of the science house at NASA, which looks for other planets. I would love to hear that President Obama, yeah, thought that finding new Earths would be wonderful. Not that we're going to plan on trashing this planet, moving to another Earth, because the speed of light pretty much stops us from doing that, but just from the point of view of giving everyone hope and excitement about realizing that there are other Earth-like planets out there, which probably have life on them, and shouldn't we do a much better job of taking care of our own Earth and protecting it for our own species?
Well, there might actually, Alan, I know, be some practical applications to this, in that understanding if we happen to come upon another Earth that has had life in the past or is at the beginning stages, we can extrapolate information based on that about what might happen to us.
Absolutely. The folks who study how life originated on our Earth and evolved, the so-called astrobiologists, I would love to see a nearby Earth-like planet, because we want to study that thing to depth. We want to understand how life, you know, really got going. We would love to be able to understand what our own Earth was like 3 or 4 billion years ago. We have some hints of it from the fossil record on Earth, but those hints are often hard to decipher. So if we actually could have a nearby world where we thought life was just sort of getting underway, that would be fantastic for the field of astrobiology. I think it also would have some rather intriguing implications if we found a world which we thought was perhaps post-intelligence, perhaps one where, gee, there seems to be an awful lot of carbon dioxide in its atmosphere, and gee, its temperature of its atmosphere seems to be much too hot for what it should be compared to what we thought it should be for its distance from the sun, and gee, there seems to be these technologically associated molecules in its atmosphere, like chlorofluorohydrocarbons, which cause the ozone hole, and so, gee, this place seems like it once had life, doesn't seem to have life now because we're not getting any radio signals from it. What happened? You know, maybe that's a situation which is perhaps the worst case scenario for Earth, that the intelligent life came and screwed up the planet so badly that it was only fit for thermophilic bacteria thereafter, no longer for intelligent life. So I think if we found a world like that, that would have major implications for what we should be doing on our own planet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mark in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hi. It's great to be on the show. It's an honor, really.
Oh, great to have you.
I'm excited to be on it. Anyways, I'm curious to know if the recent discovery that the Milky Way galaxy is, I think they said, 50% larger than what was originally thought, affected any of the preparations for the Kepler mission or any of the instruments, you know, required. I would think it would, given the fact that it's going to be looking at a much larger galaxy now.
Well, it certainly makes the fact that the Milky Way galaxy has a lot of planets mean it has perhaps 50% more planets, because basically we have 50% more stars for planets to be around them. Presumably we have 50% more stars. But it doesn't really change the way that the Kepler mission has been designed or how it will operate, because Kepler had already chosen ahead of time its field of stars to look at, which is in the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra, a little bit above the galactic plane, but not far away from the galactic pole, the idea being to find just a very rich field of stars to not be so close to, together that the there's crowding issues, like towards the galactic plane, but also you want to have a lot of them, so you're not looking at the galactic pole either. So they found an ideal field of stars in those constellations. And out of the something like 4 million or so stars that are cataloged in that field of view, they picked out the best several hundred thousand of them, and then went through the laborious process of finding the best 170,000 targets out of those, because unfortunately Kepler has a lot of data. You know, they're going to be taking pictures every 30 minutes, basically, of that entire field of stars, 10 degrees on a side, and have to download that data back to the Earth for it to be analyzed. And there's only a limited amount of deep space network time that JPL is willing to give any one NASA mission, because everyone has to share the same space network. And so Kepler is basically limited to only bringing down data for 170,000 stars. And so those 170,000 stars have already been inscribed in stone, as it were, and Kepler will be following them for the next 3.5 years. And as the Kepler spacecraft moves farther away and it gets harder to get data back down, we're going to have to narrow that down to the best 100,000 stars. And so Kepler will, at the end of 3.5 years, have really a good data stream on at least 100,000 stars. And those stars we are pretty much already chosen now. There is some flexibility as more interesting things happen along the way. Kepler can add a few stars and take off some which turn out not to be so good. But basically, those 100,000 stars, their names are already pretty much known now.
What happens if something breaks?
That is something we don't really want to think about.
But if there were problems with Hubble, of course.
Sure, sure. In a sense, Kepler is a much simpler mission than Hubble. It has no moving parts. Once Kepler has a dust cover, which protects its telescope from dust and debris, and once that dust cover is blown off, which will happen in another week or two, Kepler has no moving parts, basically. It just takes data, stares at one area of the sky for 3.5 years, and they're in the process of testing the telescope right now. And so one hopes that the electronics will not fail. That's one of the problems that the Hubble Space Telescope has. But in the case of Kepler, Kepler is on what's called an Earth-trailing orbit, where it is leaving the Earth-Moon system. It's actually several times the Moon's distance from the Earth already. It's already leaving us, getting farther away from us. And so there's no hope whatsoever of ever going back and trying to fix Kepler if something should go wrong with it. Unlike Hubble, Hubble was intentionally built so that it could be serviced by astronauts.
Alan Boss is with us. His new book is called The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Back in a minute, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is astrophysicist Alan Boss. His new book is called The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. On the phone right now, we have Bruce in Aledo. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Terrific program. Thank you for it. Earlier, you answered my original question about how does Kepler help us in our search for extraterrestrial life? But my question now is, in your educated opinion, how close are we to that, which in my opinion would be the biggest news story in the history of human civilization, and is it going to actually happen? What do you think?
Well, Kepler will tell us how frequently Earths occur, and based on what has already been found by the ground-based planet hunters using primarily Doppler, the expectation is that Kepler is going to find that sun-like planets typically often have an Earth-like planet. You know, something like not perhaps 100% of them, but maybe 80-90% of them are going to have at least one Earth-like world, which is a phenomenal prediction to see if it actually comes true. Since Kepler will be looking at 100,000 stars, and roughly 1/100th of them should be oriented such that their Earth-like planets could transit, that means that Kepler potentially could find of order 100,000 Earths. Certainly, he'll probably find hundreds of Earths at the very least. And so once Kepler does that, we will know how frequently Earths occur, and then we'll be able to, basically 4 years from now, when Kepler gives us that number, we'll be able to make the case to the public and to the president and to the NASA administrators that we should take the next step. and begin building the next space telescopes that will actually find evidence for Earth-like planets around the closest stars, because the Earth that Kepler will find will not be terribly close to us. They'll be all towards the constellation Cygnus and Lyra, and they'll typically be maybe 1,500 light-years away or 2,000, 3,000 light-years away. So they're not the ideal ones to follow up on. Instead, we'll want to search for the planets in our neighborhood of the city, basically. You know, Kepler will be looking for houses that might be inhabitable on the other side of the city. We want to look for the houses on our block. How many of them have their lights on, implying there's something alive and they're going on? And we, as I hinted before, JPL has several different projects underway which could build a space telescope capable of direct detection. They also have an intermediate mission called the Space Interferometry Mission, which could look for the wobbles of stars nearby, and looking now not for the Doppler wobble, but for the back-and-forth motion of the star on the sky, the so-called astrometric planet detection technique, which also can work quite nicely. And that so-called Space Interferometry Mission, or SIM, could detect Earth-like planets around, say, the closest 65 or so stars. That would tell us exactly which houses live on our block that are potentially habitable. And then perhaps JPL would be able to build one of the terrestrial planet finder telescopes, the ones that we talked about before, the coronagraph or the interferometer, which would then be able to go look at those 65 closest houses and see if the lights are on, see if we can see evidence in their atmospheres for the biomarkers, carbon dioxide, water, ozone, methane. And that is that's quite doable. There's no reason not to do it, except for the shortage of funds, which is always the main drawback for NASA programs. But that could be done basically within 10 years after we give them the green light to go. There's a bit of technology development to do first, but once that green light is given, we could have the answer basically within 10 to 15 years from now. And it's pretty much infallible in some sense. If we build these space telescopes, we know how to do them, and assuming they work right and don't crash in the ocean when we launch them, we'll know the answer 10, 15 years from now.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Up next, we have Tony in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Hi. I've never called in before. This is my first time.
Welcome.
Thank you. I was just wondering what your speaker, his opinion was that if our solar system may have an undiscovered binary companion, possibly a brown dwarf, it's also known as Planet X or Nibiru, that's in a 3,600-year orbit around the sun. And I was just, I'll take my answer off the air. I was just wondering what his opinion was.
Thanks. Alan, what do you think?
A 3,600-year period is a relatively short period. I would think that if there was a brown dwarf, even which is which is actually fairly massive and bright in some sense compared to some of the other objects that we see in our outer solar system, I would hope that we would have found that by now, but who knows? If it's on an odd orbit where it's not in the ecliptic plane where most of the other planets are, when planet searches and comet searches tend to concentrate, maybe there's something out there that hasn't been seen yet. But there's, I think what people have talked about was perhaps having a much more distant stellar companion in order to perhaps account for the so-called periodic comet showers that have been associated with mass extinctions in the past. But that would be a much longer period orbit, perhaps something like a 36 million-year period orbit. Such a binary companion is hypothetical. We do know of very, very wide binaries which exist in the galaxy. But other than that potential periodicity in the fossil extinction record, I don't think we have any good astronomical evidence for it. So it's one of these things where it's hard to predict that it's not there because until you find it, you can't say for sure whether it's there or not. But certainly astronomers need to continue mapping what's out there in our outer solar system. There's rather peculiar object called Sedna found a few years back, which is, I think, the most distant object or in terms of its mean distance from the sun that we know of. And it's sort of an oddball because it's on a highly eccentric orbit. And the fact that it's out there implies that something must have excited it earlier on in its orbital evolution. And that's one of the evidences for saying that perhaps the solar system was born in the cluster of stars, and we got kicked out of that cluster of stars earlier on. And the process of that, doing that kick-out process, perhaps suddenly had its orbit excited by a close encounter with this other star or group of stars. And that's one of the lines of dynamical evidence that we use to infer how the solar system formed. But in order to further improve that viewpoint, we do need to continue our census of what exactly what is out there on the edges of our solar system. We don't know exactly what's there. There's certainly lots of Kuiper Belt objects and Oort cloud comets. And whether or not there happens to be a brown dwarf floating out there or not, we'd love to know if one's there.
Some of the work that you've done has looked at planet migration, which is not the same as an orbit. This is a planet actually sort of moving around within the space where it exists. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That was one of the major surprises of the very first planet found around a Sun-like star, 51 Peg, found by the Swiss astronomers Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz back in 1995. 51 Peg looked in many ways like a Jupiter. It had an estimate of roughly a half a Jupiter mass from the Doppler wobble amplitude. It had a pretty much circular orbit. The only surprising thing about it was that its orbital period was not 12 years like Jupiter, but actually 4.23 days. And by Kepler's third law, that means that it's orbiting its star roughly 100 times closer than Jupiter does. And that was a real surprise, because even now we cannot imagine making a gas giant planet so close to a star by either of the two competing mechanisms that we hinted at earlier on, basically building up a rocky core first or having a clump form directly out of the gas and dust. We still think you have to make Jupiter-like planets more like Jupiter distances from our sun, more or less where Jupiter is right now. That seems to be the best place to assemble such planets. So the fact that 51 Peg was discovered in 1995 implied that something that theorists like myself had worried about for many years, namely that once you make a planet, it might actually start moving around the disk and not stay put, that actually happened in the case of 51 Peg. And so that's actually one of the major areas for theoretical inquiry right now, is I think there are more theorists worrying about how to make planets move around rather than worrying about how to make them. So the migration theorists tend to say, all right, given a planet, let's assume the planet exists, and have it interact with either other planets or planetesimals, or have it interact with the gaseous disk, let's see where it's going to go. And that's a very fruitful area. It's basically a cottage industry now for theorists. More papers appear right now about moving planets around solar systems than appear worrying about how to make them in the first place.
Let's go next to Corey in Dallas. Hello, Corey.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. A couple questions about the Doppler effect. On the one hand, is there any way to distinguish a star rotating around the fulcrum point in the universe versus a star rotating around, let's say, a black hole? And is there any importance in making that distinction? And secondly, I'm wondering where we are in terms of our own sun's movement, and whether we're drawing closer or pulling away, and what impact that can have on climate change.
So for the first question about whether or not a black hole could be causing the wobble, yeah, that certainly is a possibility. If you have a black hole with a rather small mass, like the mass of a Jupiter, that could very well be what would be causing a planet or the star to wobble around the center of mass. Since these are all indirect detections, that is a conceivable alternative. However, I think there are other reasons, based on our understanding of what leads to black holes, that it would be unlikely to have a black hole, which is thought to be the remnant of a collapse of a very massive star, to have such an object occur around a solar-type star, which is typically with ages of a few billion years, and very much like our own sun. We can't think, I think, very easily of any astrophysical scenario that would have a very massive star, a star with maybe a mass of 10 or 15 solar masses, explode as a supernova and leave behind a black hole, and then still have a sun-like star sitting there cooking along quite nicely. So even though it cannot be ruled out on the basis of simple dynamics, I think from astrophysical scenarios it would be rather unlikely. I wasn't quite sure what the thrust of your second question was about the changes of the Earth's orbit from the sun. Is that what you're talking about, and the effects of climate change from that?
I think he was asking, whether the Earth is moving closer to the sun, whether that could have an impact on climate change.
Sure. The main changes in the Earth's orbit are simply due to the fact that the Earth's orbit is not a complete circle. It's just a little bit eccentric. It has an eccentricity of, 0.02. So we do actually change our distance from the sun by a relatively small amount. And that is factored into climate change models, but there are other things which I think are even more important, which have to do with the change of the tilt of the Earth with respect to the sun, and how much the northern hemisphere is being illuminated by the sun versus the southern hemisphere, and those cycles are well-known and studied. And so all of those things are taken into climate models, at least ones who are really worrying about the long-term changes in climate, as opposed to just worrying about timescales of a few hundreds of years, which is, of course, the main concern right now. But over timescales of tens of thousands of years, you have to worry about these other changes in Earth's spin axis orientation, as well as the position of the Earth and the sun. But in terms of orbital migration, the Earth is basically not migrating at all compared to what we talk about in the case of the hot Jupiters. The hot Jupiters are migrating because they had interactions with a rather massive amount of gas and dust left over from the planet formation process, or else interactions with other bodies which had not yet been accreted by some planet. And the solar system now at 4.5 billion years after its formation is long since having had any migration going on. with the exception, of course, of some things like Pluto and the outer Kuiper Belt objects. There are still migrations going on of smaller objects which happen to scatter off each other, or inside the asteroid belt. There's the so-called Kirkwood gas, which are the remnants of where meteorites have come from asteroids which have gotten kicked around the solar system. So in terms of the Earth, though, Earth is pretty much good and stable. That's not a concern for climate change. It's more the known changes in the obliquity of the Earth, the spin axis orientation, things like that.
So, Alan, in terms of sentient life elsewhere in the universe, there's this fascinating question that may be as much philosophical as it is scientific, but I'm curious about where you stand on the idea that perhaps being intelligent is a greater liability than it is an advantage to particular species.
Well, from the point of view that we can do things to our atmosphere by burning coal and burning oil and creating chlorofluorocarbons, which produce ozone holes, yes, that in the short term at least is certainly a clear liability. On the other hand, we're not so stupid as a species to not be aware of what we're doing. It really becomes more a question of will, of technological will, to figure out a way to do it in a different way so that we don't have the problem anymore. And most importantly of all, of course, is the political will and the economic will to make sometimes the hard choices that have to be made to change our behavior patterns so that we can not take the easiest possible course, but take perhaps a course which is harder, but in the long run will ensure the survival of our species as well as all the other species that we share the planet with. So I'm quite hopeful that human beings are not really going to be leading ourselves down a one-way dead end to extinction. I think we are intelligent species. And we're going to survive. There are other things, though, that may be out of our control that, when a large asteroid comes in and whacks us someday, that one it may be a little bit harder to take care of. There are other threats to our existence. And even the long term, I think it's just a question of the time scale of human beings is disproportionately short compared to the time scales of astronomy. Stars exist for billions and billions of years. Our own sun is something like 4.5 billion years old. The universe is thought to be something like 13.87 billion years old, plus or minus a day or two. Whereas human beings, depending on which anthropologist you talk about, which you want to call a human being, have really only been around for maybe 100,000, 160,000 years. And so, those time scales are quite short compared to the astronomical time scales. So whether or not human beings will still be here 100,000 years from now or will have evolved into a new species, who knows? But certainly I would say a billion years from now, we're not going to be here. Something else will be here, not us.
And in the 15 seconds we have left, do you expect that some of the major facts that we currently take for granted as true about the universe will ultimately be disproven as we learn more?
I would say 10%. I'd say we are 90% of the way there.
That's encouraging. Alan Boss is a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. His new book is called The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Alan, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.